Welcome to Planetary Conversations. I'm your host, Warren Bell. Each week I talk with experienced and knowledgeable guests from all backgrounds and walks of life as we explore ideas and actions that can restore the health of our planet and heal our relations with one another. Check out our website at voiceoftheshoeshop.ca, and you can find all our episodes on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. But first, we openly and freely acknowledge that we live and work in Shukapmakulu, the stolen, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Suquepic people. We in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our very best to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory to our Indigenous friends and neighbors. Our guest today is someone who decided early on in his life that he wanted to be a good person and to live out his ideals. Throughout his life, educator and pastor Dan Meeks, who's living in Salmon Arm, has endeavored to be helpful to others in one way or another. A sense of empathy for others' struggles, a desire for justice, and a love of the natural world are important elements in Dan's life. And over the years, he's acted on these sentiments and tried to do what he can to make things right for others. Whether he's been working as a logger, a farmer, a teacher, a business owner, or an Anglican priest, these guiding principles have animated his decision-making and his actions. Today we're going to talk with Dan about what he's done and what he's doing and what he still hopes to accomplish in the future. Dan, it's great to have you join us here today.
Well, good morning, Warren. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, we're certainly delighted to have you because you've been involved in so many projects and activities. When you're just thinking of yourself, how do you describe yourself in the universe, your position in the universe?
Well, I think of being a student. Today I'm wearing my UBC sweatshirt because this experience is probably another learning experience. The world's changing extremely quickly, and to sit down and listen to the sounds around you is really important if you're going to build community.
Well, that's a pretty good description. I think anybody who's listening would like to be able to say that about themselves. A couple of weeks ago, you were involved as guest speaker at an event called the Peace and Pizza event. It's a third Friday every month now. It's an initiative spearheaded by Peace Builders, which is an outgrowth of the Rotary movement. And the process is coordinated here in Salmon Arm by Mike Boudreau. Now, just so listeners know, Peace Builders, the organization behind the event, in its website says its role is to empower active volunteers in grassroots peace-building initiatives that foster social harmony, dismantle barriers, and reduce disharmony. And it's aiming to build community where everyone feels they belong and are valued for who they are and the gifts they bring to the world. So what was it like speaking at this particular event for you? What is your take on what happened and how it went?
Well, the event is open to anyone. And what's exciting about it is that there's a sense of everyone is equal. Everyone belongs. Eating a meal together and then listening and sharing people's stories is a very powerful experience.
How did the audience react to what you had to say? How did they respond?
I think the response, I would say, was one that people went away and reflected on. I had a simple thing, and I said, just go pick one friend. In the middle of a world where there's so many dehumanizing forces, the simplest thing you can do is find one person and listen, be with other people.
And how was pizza?
Pizza's always good.
Now, your project for that evening was to talk about EDSAI. Why don't you tell listeners what EDSAI stands for and what's the basic purpose behind it?
So I think, first of all, it's important to talk the context that this concept comes out of. At the First Community Wednesdays, there's lunch, and 100 people show up from a variety of places. And when they gather, they're with people they wouldn't normally be with. And so they all have lunch, and those of us who took a step back and said, what's actually happening here, realized that the common denominator wasn't that people were homeless or that they were aging on small pensions. The common ground was that they were outside of the economy. They were disconnected from the economy. And secondly, that they were socially isolated. People came together. And so economically disconnected, socially isolated.
EDSI.
Yes, that's correct.
That's so for listeners who can't see my notes here, the EDSI stands for economic disconnection and social isolation.
Yes.
That's what the acronym stands for.
Yes.
When you say economic disconnection, does that mean that they don't have money, or does it mean they don't have a role, a job, a sort of?
Well, I think there's three things in that. The first one is that they do not have the freedom to acquire financial resources in any way that we assume happens with a job. So many people are in very limited pensions. Or they're doing occasional work, but they're just not in the mainstream of the ongoing economy. Mm. The second part of that is that they do not have the access to do that even if they want to. And that may be for a whole bunch of factors, including age and physical ability and so on. And the third thing is the implications of that is there is never quite enough money. So budget-wise, you're always...
Always scrambling.
Yeah, just surviving.
Who is involved with this project? Obviously, you are. You're playing a central role. Who else or what other entities are involved with this?
Well, we've gathered some of the folks from Rotary. We've gathered some folks from First Community and the nonprofit organizations within the community that are related to those persons have also contributed some leadership. Hmm.
One of the points that you make early on in a paper that you left with me and that describes EDSI in considerable detail is that the notion of building homes for the homeless is just not enough. It's too narrow a goal. Why don't you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, if you're socially isolated, quite often the most significant thing about your home now is the people that you used to spend time with, the people you hung out with. Now they may not be able to be with you. And so having the physical roof is a huge asset, but it's very limited in terms of building relationships. Mm. Belonging in our society is the most critical thing to strong mental health. And so if you become isolated, then your mental health is very vulnerable.
Yes. The project in Ontario with the guaranteed basic income, first finding in a study done by McMaster of the outcomes, was that 87% of the people who were part of this project, which said you'll have enough basic cash available to you to survive, as it were, have a place to live and buy food. 87% of people experienced a significant uplift in their mood, in their feelings about themselves and about their lives. Now, there's a number of comments that I was intrigued by this paper, and I went through it carefully. And there's a number of things that you said there that are really considering problems that we all share. One is that social assistance, as it now stands, the sort of financial support, the material support you get through social agencies, rarely covers all expenses. It's not enough for people to be, in a very basic way, secure.
Warren, I think that's one of the most critical factors in our society right now, is if you don't have quite enough money, then you don't have the resources to change your relationship with the economy. So you're putting to a holding pattern, and with that, having received the money, you now learn how to be helpless.
Indeed, and whether you wanted to be helpless or not, you are in a position where you often are considered that way. It seems to me that the social support system, if you want to call it, has become more impoverished over time. Since, say, World War II, when the social safety net was built up. I've noticed changes in it that make it less successful at fulfilling the basic needs of people. Is that something you've seen as well?
I think it's very complex, and that's why we've had a task force that's looking at the complexity of the issue. One of the key things is that in an investment economy that we're evolving into, one of the most profitable things to invest in is housing. And like so many industries, the housing industry is a cartel. Mm. It guarantees that everybody will find the highest possible price. So for the person who's a renter, the vulnerability, and in our economy, everything is becoming rented. It irritates me that I can't buy software. everything in my life is leased or borrowed or yeah. something with an implied
It's a service contract. You get to use it until we decide we don't want you to use it anymore, the producer of what is there. It's interesting because real estate, we had Paul Kershaw from UBC on the show a little while ago, and he pointed out that the biggest asset that has increased in people's lives for seniors in particular is real estate. If they bought a house 50, 30, 20 years ago, its value has increased enormously. But if you don't happen to have a house or a home or a fixed asset like that, you really have very little. As you just said, you're living from one act of reimbursement to another, and you have to prove that you are worthy of it often. You don't just get it as an automatic thing.
I think that some of the people in that regard that are most vulnerable are people who are on one pension, living in an apartment, or single person's pensions. And as the rent goes up, they're more and more vulnerable to renovating or whatever the landlord chooses to do.
Now, you drew attention to another thing. You said that, and I'll just quote here, early attachments to caregivers, especially mothers, shape neurological and psychological and personal development. It's a sort of well-understood factor that how you end up, the trajectory you follow in your life is shaped by the kind of early patterns established in that life. And the ability to feel comfortable in the wider community is often sharply demarcated by what sort of things have happened as you're growing up. And you quoted some research that's been done on with laboratory animals, which if you give them a really comfortable environment to live in, they do far better. Bruce Alexander, you're quoting from Simon Fraser, and his research would show clearly that if rats in a cage have a really lovely environment, lots of toys to play with and companions to hang out with, they don't search, for example, support from morphine, which is the drug he used. They start to proliferate and their behavior improves. Well, humans, we're not rats in a maze, but we have some biological characteristics that are like that. If we have a supportive environment, we do better.
Well, it's about finding some place of contentment and the endorphins that allow us to feel simple pleasure and comfort in life. Mm. And if you don't receive those, the inclination to use substances that give you some sense of contentment is very, very high. So what happens in childhood and as kids grow up and so on is profound. And in fact, that whole area, those of us who are starting to look at this closely feel extremely nervous because between cell phones and all sorts of other things, we're not producing resilient young people. Mm. And a significant part of young people will not ever go to work.
You quoted some other authors on this very subject about how the digital social platforms, social media, as we call them, have actually been, they bring people together superficially, but they isolate people in their direct and full lives. They're cut off. And this is something you talked about, social intimacy in Western cultures. And this is something that is really becoming quite a, even basic social skills for young people, for example, are in abeyance because they spend, instead of looking at their friend in the face and talking to them, they look at the digital device in their hand and they talk to it, or if they don't even talk to it, they just type into it.
Well, in the digital world for people who are adolescents, the greatest challenge is that all digital media presents an environment of comparison, constant comparison. And it's kind of the new concept that's come from our competitiveness as individuals in an industrial society. So for kids, the idea that somehow there's an ideal young person out there, this is what they look like, this is what they do, and so on, is the baseline. And then your peers compare you. And we've built a culture where kids are actually pretty vicious to each other, particularly going through puberty, where they all the things that they are not become emphasized. And so, yeah, we have many young people that are very vulnerable. I mean, our rates of suicide among girls has doubled in a 10-year period. And so part of our whole EDSCI study and initiatives is looking at the long run, being anticipatory of what kind of world are we building. And we come back to the same point that some 75-year-old person living in their own apartment has, where they feel vulnerable and isolated.
You make a point that support systems, if they don't come from your own initiative, are often, or reliance on them is often looked down upon. You say here in the document, reliance on social systems is typically stigmatized. It's a sign of, you know, in the competitive atmosphere you're describing, it's considered a failure. It's considered you haven't been able to get yourself enough security, you need to rely. That idea of stigmatization, of getting support from society as a whole, it seems like an odd thing to have that considered a lowering of, or something that lowers your esteem in the eyes of your peers.
Well, the whole American vision of the self-made person riddles everything that we do. It's present, it's there.
We live too close to that particular elephant.
Well, I think it comes with empires, and we just happen to be close to that one. The status in the British Empire was the same thing. I grew up in Victoria, and going to high tea and knowing how to walk and talk was all part of the individual becoming acceptable.
And on that note, you make a very clear comment about First Nations and how they have experienced a dismantling not only of their economic, but of their cultural and spiritual foundations. We've taken all that away so that you're dependent, you as an Indigenous person become dependent on the state, but the state doesn't look at you as a meaningful contributor to its values and its meaning.
Well, the core of Department of Inuit Affairs for 100 years was systematic training of people to be learned helpless. Yes. And so rebuilding a culture from its ancient roots is really complicated. And many of the people that have grown up in that environment find no home.
Isn't it interesting how much... How Indigenous culture went sort of underground because there were very vigorous active attempts to suppress it, but among elders, among quiet corners of the Indigenous world, a great deal of the culture was sustained. It just was invisible and publicly denigrated, but quietly it started to kind of resurface and come back, and ceremonial processes and value systems are actually reemerging, as it were, from the undergrowth or from the social undergrowth.
I think it's true, and one of the reasons for that is what was destroyed first among Indigenous peoples was their economy, and the economy feeds the culture, the wealth. The ability not only for material culture, but family life and so forth. So between disease, residential, schools, it was really the second phase. The first phase was the economy. So all the trade routes and all the dialogue between nations and the creativity that came from bargaining, fish for furs or whatever, when that was gone, a lot of what was Indigenous identity was long. And in recovery now, what's interesting for me is that the most significant people in a lot of Indigenous programs that address issues of addiction involve elders, and it's the values that lay the foundation for new lives.
One of the features that the extractivist capitalist economy has generated is the contamination of the ecosystem, so that economies that were dependent, as you described, on local food and local acquisition of food and trading back and forth can no longer function because the very food is inedible or is the cause of sickness and ill health, something that we're all struggling with now because it's affecting everybody worldwide, but in particular, Indigenous cultures have been decimated by this pollution, this contamination of the very food that they would have eaten for, as they say often, time immemorial.
I think the powerful thing of Indigenous cultures that I've learned to have a deep respect for is that belonging is not just about your village or your clan, but you belong to the earth.
Mm.
And so in terms of identity and strong mental health, knowing that you're related to everything that you see in that created order out there is a powerful foundation for anyone's mental health.
Yes, and even as you were saying that, I was just having this little shiver running through me that what a wonderful way to live in the world, to see everything around you as valuable and meaningful and having a place and deserving respect, especially the things that occur in the natural world without us actually, you know, making a plan and paying out a purchase order. They're there.
Well, in a new order that's unfolding, that will be a critical kind of salvation or way of reconnecting in terms of healthy lives. Because if you are addicted to a screen, your sense of existence is without geography.
Yes.
And the very roots of how you understand yourself is an energy on cyberspace, that the reality of which is very, very subjective.
That rootlessness, that feeling of just not having a place to be.
Yes, and so that's part of the challenge of those of us who are concerned with the society that's unfolding, is how is it that young people are connected to the world that's around them? Yuval Harari suggested that's an irrelevant question now. We will not be conscious of the fact that we're not conscious anymore. We're simply managed by the algorithms that appease us, and so I think that the whole kind of social belonging becomes really important.
As a physician, I'm often confronting people with the fact that they live first of all in a body that they cannot pretend that they do not, and second of all that they live in a place where there are things happening that that alter and transform their health one way or the other, and it's unavoidable. We all come there. Now, you, in terms of what is valuable and what is important, you've made in this document about EDSAI that one of the main challenges is to find effective ways to redistribute wealth, because we as a culture are doing, a global and local culture are doing a less effective job of redistributing wealth, not just money, but also the kinds of assets that make life worth living, and the continuity of relations with other people, of course, is an important part of that. Why don't you talk a little bit about that, the notion of how redistributing wealth to reduce the gap between the very wealthy and the not wealthy has become something we have to really start thinking about better.
I would want to come back, first of all, to the point that we make more on the housing we buy over a lifetime than many of us make in their wages.
Yes, Paul Kershaw made exactly that point.
Yeah. The only wealth I have is the value of my house.
Yeah,
I've chosen to spend a lifetime at wages that were pretty modest. Mm. And so if that is where wealth is at, the first thing that is a barrier is housing. And it's different from the social question of how do I belong. It's about how do I have safe space. And so I think that the two things that are going to have to be questioned with in the investment economy is that there has to be a whole set of housing that has nothing to do with investment. It's taken out of the market. Whether that's state housing or how that's structured, I would leave that for politicians to argue their way through. The second thing is how do we create social wealth? And this one is a big one that no politician has talked about yet, but within 5 years will be upon us. And that is the whole world of pensions and our social network and so on. As less and less of us work, and that's a situation with a society run by AI, as less and less of us work, how do we generate the wealth to care for the society and those that are not directly involved in the economy? And is it guaranteed annual income? If so, what do we tax?
Yes.
Because if there's less income tax for those working, how do you pay for any of the social net, whether it's universal medical care or whatever it might be? How does you socially pay the bills? Some economies like Norway have created sovereign funds where the wealth of the community. And I ran in 84 when we were federally, when we were arguing about how did we manage the oil industry. And at that time, there was going to be Petro-Canada, National Corporation, and so on. Norway did. Mm-hmm. Norway has the largest sovereign fund in the world.
It's gigantic.
And their pension started 70,000 American for old age pension. And so it's an economy that is very wealthy because socially, they said, the oil industry is commons. It's commonly held.
Yes, that's right.
Disputes with Alberta meant that heritage funds and so on were carried, all spent. So we've attempted to go in that direction. And I sat with Cabinet in Alberta at the point that all the treading water was occurring in the middle of the last oil recession. And so when we start to think about our wealth, we have lots of questions because how do we have universal housing? How do we deal with pensions when in actual fact our tax structure needs to evolve quite dramatically?
In Norway, the tax on the oil and gas industry was as high as 50%, meaning that every dollar that was earned, 50% went into a public purse, which eventually became the sovereign fund. In Alberta, the tax rate was 5% or less, and that 5% wasn't enough to replenish social support systems and make meaningful redistribution of wealth a possibility. One other thing, and I'd like be interested to hear what you have to say about in Norway, it's common practice when you have committed some kind of criminal act and you are being incarcerated, when you arrive at the prison, they shake your hand and say, "Welcome. Now, we'd like to find out what we can do to equip you with tools to go back into society. What kind of education program would you like to undertake?" In other words, it's a demonstration that your action at that particular point is not the end of things. You may have undertaken a criminal act, stealing something, but you are still somebody we want to put back. And the recidivism rate is remarkably lower than that in, say, North America. It's, you know, like 25% as opposed to 85%. You make a comment in this paper that personal histories are really critical in terms of why people end up marginalized or shunted out of the mainstream of a society. And that, of course, brought to my mind the research being done on PTSD, the stress that comes from experiences that you have in your life, and also a whole body of research around adverse childhood experiences, which has been, for example, able to show that the risk of addiction to chemicals that alter mood and mind-altering chemicals is radically increased when experiences in your early developmental years are harmful or destructive or traumatizing. What do you see as that as indication of things that we need to do differently, somehow supporting early childhood systems that give families and mothers and parents an opportunity to have the supports they need to feel comfortable and to raise their children in a way that is appropriate and gives them tools to use in the rest of their lives?
Well, I think that just valuing childhood and not thinking of childhood as a product is really critical. So learning how to manage freedom and how to create are two central things of childhood. And by and large, in our industrial mass production kind of education, we've looked as accumulation of information as being a central thing in education. So you learn how to do this formula or whatever. The reality is that in our world, the most challenging thing now is emotional. And the formation and the unfortunate incidents of some kids' lives, without managing that society, we spend an incredible amount of money. And it goes right through from fostering. Actually, it's interesting. Fostering is the greatest source of people who are homeless.
That so, tells you something about the quality of the interactions.
Yeah, if it doesn't go well, it's a hell of a trip.
Yes.
You know, it gets worse. So, so looking at emotional formation is foundational for the future society, mm-hmm. because in actual fact, gathering information has become a trivia. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't matter what kind of artificial intelligence now, you will find the information. The question is, are you emotionally solid enough to be able to see the significance of the information, or is it all trivia?
That's something that's the debate around AI is all around what purpose do we put it to? And it's not, people don't seem to talk about a social, an expansion of social awareness and social value. Now, traditionally, support for people in emotional distress or need has been centered around religious and spiritual institutions. And some of the ones in seminar, I was quite surprised to hear that the sales volume of the church thrift store is $1.4 million. In other words, it's not a minor presence on the scene. And what it does is it supplies for people who need it clothing and shelter, you know, food, clothing, and shelter, the three essentials. It supplies two of them at a very modest cost to people who are in need of something of that nature. 140 volunteers and 40 full and part-time employees. Why don't you talk about the role of institutions like spiritual, religious institutions and some of the things that they have created, some of the initiatives they've created in addressing some of the issues we're talking about?
Well, I think there's two aspects of that that's important to just flag. The first one is that historically, religious institutions, irrespective of where they come from, Buddhist to Christians and so forth, have all wrestled with the meaning of life. And an important part of that has been, this is the nature of your social relationships and the values that are implied in having to live with other people. The second part has been to intervene with those who are politically and economically powerless. And so that's been a second aspect of it. What's interesting in the community is that we have an inordinately large group of professional people assisting people who are vulnerable. And then we have a group of nonprofits, and the thrift store is one of that, and churches are part of that. I think that the nonprofit sector creates the environment in which professionals can live out their careers. So yes. that if you have some place where someone goes and they get cheap commodities and so on, it's a remedy to get to tomorrow. It takes care of the immediate things. And so between nonprofits like AA, the churches and so forth, there's about 1,000 people that give time to the social fabric of the community, trying to make it a better place. And for every person that is without a fixed address, there's probably 10 volunteers. And so you start to say, so what is it we're actually doing that everybody's held in a holding pattern? I spent years on Skid Row in Vancouver, and I couldn't believe that there was four or five times as many volunteers working in soup kitchens and so on as there were who were living in extreme poverty. And so we've created, despite all the religious aura and so forth, the inability to change this class and existence of many people.
It sounds like what you're talking about and many other people are talking about, it is structural poverty, structural inequity. It's not something where the individual is responsible for the inequity. They are part of a structure that generates inequity on a regular basis. And you make an interesting point in this paper, and it struck me very much because I'm part of the professional services sector as a physician. You said professional services focus on problem solving rather than fostering a sense of belonging or empowerment. To me, that seems like a very potent statement because it's summarizing the let's patch up this problem here today, right at this moment, and how do we create an atmosphere, a social matrix in which people feel empowered and a sense of belonging. You can't just solve, you know, each individual crisis. You have to create a system that doesn't generate the crises in the first place.
I think that's quite true. And I think that when we're going through a restructuring of our economy and how we actually learn, all those things that are being restructured at the same time, we should say, how do we build communities that enable people to solve their own problems? Things like health. I'm the boss of my health. And my doctor is an expediter that helps me find resources.
Once in a while when you need it, the rest of the time.
but we don't have that sense.
We're often irrelevant to people's actual lives. When you are very ill, and we can bring you back from a state of being very ill, that's, of course, a minor miracle in a person's life. But overall, the pattern that people live within or the systems that we live within are continuously generating more of those kinds of problems if we don't look at the whole system and change it. One thing that is a very practical inhibiting pattern problem when it comes to delivering services, and it's near the end of this document that you had about SDI, it's this. It says here, many service providers perceive significant risks when engaging in problem solving outside of controlled office environments. I was very struck by that because it resonates with things that I have seen over many years, not just in this area of social development, but also in the area of things like environmental protection. When Walmart was being proposed to be built in the Delta here, one of our protagonists in the group that was thought that wasn't the right place to do it, said, walk on the Delta, get out of your car and walk down on the land and see what's going on there, because then you'll know why it's important to protect it and to give it its own space. And socially, that's the same thing, and you're describing it here. People in their offices pushing paper and filling out forms and documenting things are not doing the same thing as somebody who's actually out in the community, on the streets or in the homes, talking to people and, you know, connecting with them directly. Why don't you comment on that?
I think that we have created what is called professional, and we have a stereotype of what that should be. Some of the most helpful people for those without a fixed address are nurses who work the streets. And that's been a tradition for about 40 years in BC. But they often fly solo. I mean, there'll be maybe two nurses, but they don't have a follow-up cadre of people to actually solve the problems. Every couple of weeks, I take garbage from one of the camps. And I've gotten to know all the people in the camp, and I bring the shovels, and they fill the trailer and throw all the bags on and all the rest of it. And at this point, I'm fairly clear how the community works, who's a criminal, who's trying to take care of someone else, who is likely to provide resources to someone else. The social structure of that camp is very clear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you're putting people into housing, you have a cohort that can live together. And yet one of the greatest challenges is when people are moved into housing, they're moved in with strangers. And so that's just one small detail of a very complex way we approach to solving problems. City officials look at it and say, what a mess, and whose land is it, and who's the argument? And some benevolent person in another department of government says, no, let them stay. And out of nowhere, somebody provides an outhouse. And so you go, actually, we silently already meet some of the crises of individual lives. But it's very little to do with people's professional roles.
Yes.
It's a little to do with what we've invested as governments in something.
What about the concept of having people who are unhoused, who are marginalized, who are at the material level are well down the ladder, being active participants in designing the services or the support systems that we imagine, we who are not necessarily in that place in our lives? What about having them active participants and, in fact, essential components of designing support services?
I think that takes a skilled dialogue, because often people with sophisticated skills are very intimidated by what people can do and what to do when they can't do it, and they've got a funny idea or something that isn't going to work. How do you do that? So actually running stuff is kind of like a 5-year process. It starts mm-hmm. with doing this part and this part, and ownership is not developed because I gave it to you and said, fix it. A lot of First Nations programs have been dumped on them.
Yes.
And then they have been judged for what they didn't know. And so I think skilled social engineering is critical, and it has to be person-centered and culturally appropriate and so on.
And you said something I think that's important. You said it takes years. You don't just do a flash in the pan. You don't say, here's, I remember when Stephen Harper said, if you were in a residential school, we'll give you money. And so that's what happened. People who were very marginalized, often addicted, were given a check. And of course, the check was used to become more marginalized and more addicted, because that's the way a person was living. It seems to me that we have to take these issues on, not as an overnight wonder, but as an ongoing and integrated part of what we do as a society as a whole.
I think that the least skill is at the most immediate level of governance. And so that what seems to be in somebody's backyard, they can't imagine a solution, so it becomes adversarial.
Mm.
And so I was in Vernon the day that they took out the camp. And the camp was taken out with a hazmat crew and six vehicles and chainsaws, and they cut down the trees where they put tree forts to sleep in and all sorts of things. And it looked like a military exercise. And I thought, this really says how much you value you people.
And if you were somebody living in the camp and you see a crew coming in hazmat suits, it makes you feel like a leper must have felt like, 700 or 800 years ago. People don't come near you. You have to carry a bell telling everybody that you're a leper and you should be avoided, and people walk to the other side of the street.
I think it's like American ice.
Yes. Yes, a more orderly, low-key, but equally rough-edged and sometimes even brutal way of doing things. So moving on to from this important event where you spoke and were sharing your ideas, the Peace and Pizza event. This is, as they say, not your first rodeo. Well, you've lived in lots of places. As you said, you started in Victoria, and then you moved to Grand Forks. And I'm just going to list them off because you listed them off. Vancouver, Sorrento, Yukon, Kamloops, Fort McMurray, back to Sorrento, North Vancouver, and then for the last 17 years here. There, when things started out, your dad was a plumber. I think your mom was at home doing the books for your dad. But when you were 12, you had it in your mind that you wanted to become somebody involved in the spiritual end of things. You wanted to become an Anglican priest. Do you remember how that thought was generated in your heart and your mind?
Well, I think it came as kind of a survival thing, actually. The school and the church were side by side, and there was a hole in the fence. And I was a kid who constantly bumped with the system. I had learning challenges, and so when I got into trouble for something, or I just went out the back door of the school, through to the church, and it was a safe place.
What was safe about it? What made it a better place to hang out?
Well, initially there was nobody there. Oh, and so I can imagine living in a camp in a tent and saying, I'm finally safe for this night. So the people in the church were really welcoming, and I couldn't read with a darn. So when I was asked to read, it was probably one of the most painful experiences. But they all just accepted me. So I hung around and thought, okay, this could be a good gig.
What a wonderful demonstration of serendipity.
Yes.
You know, we live here, they live there. Let's go there and see what they're doing. Oh, this is nice. Let's do it. My goodness. An experience you had at one point was that when you were in Sunday school, which was not necessarily representative of the entire spiritual community, some kid winged a rock at you and knocked you out.
Took a pretty good hit, serious concussion.
Yeah.
And that molded a lot of my learning. And in that I couldn't match sound and symbol.
And back then, people were not, there was no notion of what head injuries do to people. You just, you know, if you can stand up and move, then you're okay and just get back in the swim, as it were.
That's right.
How did that contribute? I mean, was the safe place next door to the school part of where you went to not have to deal with the kinds of rough and tumble, mindless sort of things that sometimes happen in a school system?
I think so. I had a great teacher for the same year, and she was both in the school and in the church. And she kept saying how good I was doing. And then I got put into shops when I got to grade 8 because they didn't think I should do anything.
Isn't that an extraordinary thing that we used to think people who develop really important manual skills are not as smart as people who do a lot of thinking and saying words that sound complicated? That somehow that's just, I can remember it was considered a, you know, okay, you're not good enough to be in the academic stream, so you go to this other stream. What a mistake.
Well, it was. But the people in the academic role took a band. And so I went and looked at the timetable and said to the bandmaster, gee, I want to be in the band. And he said, what do you want to play? And I said, what do you need? And he said, nobody's played the stand-up bass for years. And so I said, I'll do the stand-up bass. And he went to the principal, had a big argument, and I was in the academic class.
Oh, really?
Yep.
So, but you did still play the stand-up bass?
I did, and I played in blues groups in a bar when I was 17.
Oh, dear. All those proponents of serendipity, keep listening, because we're talking about what really happens in people's lives. It's not what's on the piece of paper. Now, one of the things that was a very significant experience that went on when you were living in Grand Forks was the incarceration and suppression of Dukhobor culture. The Dukhobors, the Sons of Freedom, who, when you read about the Dukhobors as a group, they are doing sort of everything that we probably today think is a good thing to do. They were pacifists. They ate low on the food chain, in other words, a plant-based diet. They were actually vegetarians. They rejected materialism. Imagine, back then, rejecting materialism. It's sort of like saying your entire society is based on the wrong principle, because materialism, after World War II, burgeoned and became the dominant dogma. It's almost, I've often referred to it as the altar at which we worship, you know, acquisition of material things. What was that like as a child, seeing children belong to a community that at this point is considered wholly undesirable, being put behind sort of wire fences?
So, as a 7 or 8 year old kid, I didn't see people disappearing, because many of those young children, Canadians who parents had come from Russia, were removed from their homes and taken to New Denver to the internment camp from the Second World War. And so it was, you know, roughly 15 years after the Japanese internment, we interred the children of Russian immigrants who had a different lifestyle. And so it wasn't until I was older that although I saw the protest and the school bus had to go around.
And you had an uncle who was directly involved in that.
Yeah, he was a government agent, and he was involved in the process, responsible for the RCMP. And so I guess my perception as a child was that Canada was always struggling to kind of get the story right. And it wasn't until I was in university I realized how significant those days in Grand Forks were.
And how did it strike you then?
It struck me as weird. Mm. As a kid, it just seemed like a weird thing that people stripped. They burned down their houses. Mm-hmm. And 30 years later, I met one of the prison guards from Agassiz, where the women who had been charged with arson were in prison for decades. And he took great choice in harassing the women. And I thought, that deeply sown seed in Canada is there. And I still think with our whole EdSide group, there's a certain sense of judgment that permeates our society, where we want a simple solution to our failure to solve complex problems.
You described when we were talking about it earlier as a time back then when conformity itself was a social value, if you went along with the standard.
And we're returning to that time. And we see it south of us, and the influence here is significant, that there's a certain right way, and in that right way, those who can't conform have less worth.
You went through a number of educational experiences. One was the Arts One program at UBC, which was, I remember hearing about this program, and it was sort of free form. You could design your own curriculum. You would get a project, an assignment you were supposed to. Yours was something called The Forest to the City. What was that assignment that you had?
Well, it was a theme, and there was some literature that was to be read and so on. But it was looking at how society evolved. And so for me, one of the things I did was read everything Karl Marx had written that had been translated into English. Like, it was part of the change.
And Bob Dylan was in the air.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that sense of challenge was there. I think we've gone back to the late 40s and the conformity. And for those who would listen to Bob and dream of a better world, I think we engage those who are marginalized, and we restructure systems
that
are in the interest of all.
Yes, the term liberal democracy is a code for keeping the system such that those who earn have power, those who do not have no power. And there is a bit of return to that. However, I think it would be fair to say that this is a different world overall from the world of around the time of the Second World War, in that we have tools for connecting to one another. We misuse them errantly, but they're there. And we I have a feeling that we're probably going to have another discussion, Dan, one of these days, about some of the things that are going on today, because I think we're touching on some important issues, some issues about social change and retrogression and progression. Are we going forward? Are we going backward? And right now we're in a state of massive tumult where everything is up in the air, as it were. One of those, you know, the games where you pick up sticks, you throw the cards and the sticks in the air, and then they fall down and you have to deal with how they land on the ground. We're kind of in the middle of that right now.
I think it's an age of art where each person sees the beauty of their relationships and engages other people around them in a way that's meaningful, and to engage people that otherwise are on the outside. And that's art. That's the art of living.
I think that is a wonderful note for us to end today, and plan to continue having another discussion, because it's essentially stripping away some of the material trappings of life and getting down to an essential principle about relationship and meaning in one's life. Dan, it's really been delightful to have you here today, and look forward to talking again sometime in the near.
Thank you, Warren. It's been a great discussion.